Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey everybody, Austin here. I just wanted to give you a quick content warning for minutes 52 through 54 of the podcast today. We're talking about games and labor and studio closures, and as part of that discussion, we bring up the recent previews of Red Dead Redemption 2, including a comment in Kotaku about the game's inclusion of some horse genitalia and the detail therein, and the kind of production resources and focuses that go into producing something like that. And then again, at the very end of the podcast, it comes back up. So if that doesn't sound like your sort of thing, which is totally fine, go ahead and skip minutes 52 to 54, and then maybe stop the podcast just before the end, just as I'm throwing to the outro. All right, everybody. Thanks. What's good, internet? It is Monday, September 24th, and you are listening to Waypoint Radio, episode 189. I'm your host, Austin Walker. The world is on fire, and joining me today, Patrick Klepek.
Hello.
Natalie Watson.
Hi.
And Rob Zachney.
Hello.
How's everybody doing today on this fine, super busy, newsy Monday morning?
I don't know. Ask me in 15 minutes when there's another update.
You know what? I'm not going to do that. And instead, I'll talk to you about video games. That way we get a little bit of a break.
Uh-huh.
We can retreat from the world of... Sorry. I've just been handed a piece of paper, and it says that the world of video games is on fire also. Unfortunately.
Great.
Yeah, I don't want to beat around the bush. I think it's important that we have a conversation about some of the actions of last week regarding studio closures. Capcom Vancouver closed early last week, I think midweek actually, and then Telltale basically closed up shop on Friday afternoon. There were 225 employees let go of a total 250. Is that right? Anybody have that?
It was a roughly 300 person company, which 25 people okay. are left behind to
Jesus.
Kind of. I think it was put like the things that are required for shareholders and like the board of directors.
Right, which shook out to mean something that had to do partially with presumably with IP and stuff, but also to do with like the Netflix Minecraft thing that was happening. But what that meant at the high level is projects that were announced, like the Stranger Things project, are not happening. The last season of The Walking Dead,
second episode comes out tomorrow.
Right, and actually, the most important thing is what it means is that 275 odd people or whatever are out of work, and that this hit them out of the blue, or at least it hit most of them out of the blue, as far as I know, and it has provided a lot of insight into, I think, the situation of precarity that so many workers in the games industry live in day in, day out. A lot of these people have come out and have it's almost as if the burden of not talking about how shitty your work life has been was lifted. And we've heard so many stories from people now who are saying things like, yeah, we worked 50 to 70 hours a week, and also sometimes we crunched. And like, yikes. That is, if you're framing 50 to 70 hours as non-crunch work, that speaks to a sort of state of play that is unsustainable and unhealthy. Or actually, maybe the thing that I keep coming back to is like, actually, it's been very sustainable, just not for the workers, but absolutely for companies. Mm. So we should talk through what happened, and then just like, I just want to feel out where y'all are at on this stuff. Patrick, do you want to just, is there any other high level stuff that I've kind of left out about the week we had last week?
Look, one of the, you know, clarifying things or what makes the Telltale situation even worse is there has been, I have not done my own reporting on this, but there's been others reporting that folks were not given any sort of severance as a part of the Telltale layoffs. Like often when these mass layoffs happen, even when they're closures, you know, people are given some measure of financial assistance so that they have a cushion in between finding another job. Because even even if that cushion is only, you know, a couple of weeks, you have to remember if you were to sign a job the next day, those paychecks don't show up the next day. You know, it can take several weeks to a month to get into a system. You know, it's the severance is as much as about providing stability as much as like a, you know, a runway towards whatever the next job may be if you're fortunate enough to transition to one. And so the fact that there was no severance speaks to the fiscal irresponsibility that was happening at Telltale, where it's, look, lots of companies close. Sometimes things don't sell. Things go poorly. That is just the nature of the beast in video games, as competitive as they are these days, right? Like, it's never been harder to sell a game, and it's never been more expensive to make them in a lot of ways, at least in the traditional models that have been adopted. You know, the fact that when you're laying off majority of the company and you can't offer them severance speaks to, and this requires no reporting, speaks to, like, gross irresponsibility, gross negligence, lying. Like, you're giving nothing to the people that gave everything to a company that certainly did not deserve it. And yet, even despite that, had a not enough to sustain the company, obviously, but, like, there was a lot of love for Telltale. Like, there are closures. Like, the response to Capcom Vancouver closing and Capcom and Telltale closing were two different things. Like, people losing their job is bad no matter how you slice it, but, like, people had a sense of warmth with Telltale because of the kinds of games they made. And the fact that the Capcom Vancouver people are seemingly going to have a little bit more of backing as they figure out their next steps, and Telltale people are just out there living in San Francisco, you know, with that
where it is super expensive.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's. I just want to draw a distinction where it's like something is routine but bad, and this is not routine but bad. This is gross negligence in which the fact that these people are not going to be held responsible in any meaningful way is like just deeply frustrating.
To be explicit, the reason that you're saying that this is negligence is that if you were in a position, if you were in the sort of position where you were going to close down your studio, you were in the sort of position that in which you know you were going to have to close down your studio at some point soon, and to take that action before, at the point at which you can still offer severance. Whereas here, the way it reads, and this is me speculating, is that the people who are in charge of the books there, the people who have to make that sort of decision, were kind of hoping that Walking Dead Season 4 would blow up in such a way that they would get enough money to balloon the structure and actually keep people employed and keep the studio open. Mm-hmm. And that's not what happened. And that's not a sustainable way to run the business. And it actually puts more risk on your employees' heads than it does on your own in a way that is, like you said, I think fairly negligent. Natalie, did you have something to add there?
No, you know, I think that your tweet earlier this morning spoke a lot to that, where you said that, you know, if budgets aren't being put in place in advance to kind of support the kind of potential risks and potential closeout or fallout from, you know, a game not being successful, then that company was not built in a way that is sustainable, or that budget was just not a real budget. Like that whatever those numbers were were like false numbers, because they don't account for, you know, things that are necessary or that should be necessary in a company, like, you know, protecting your workers and things like that. But, you know, companies.
Well, it's like it's one of those things where this is companies be companies. Yeah, totally.
Like, if you don't have to protect your workers because there's nothing forced, like, you protect your workers because it's the right thing to do. Like, that's what this existing structure in the video game industry is. It's like the reason you give people severance is because that's what, like, a fucking
morally,
human should do. It is
morally,
ethically the right thing to do. Well, there is no law that, like, requires you to offer severance. And so the lack of severance, like, you know, and we'll get into this in, like, you know, the discussion that's happened this weekend over, like, radically rethinking how we structure the video game industry and the consequences of that. Like, there's no reason they don't have to do that. The fact that they didn't says a lot about Telltale and the people who are running it. And, you know, and speaks very clearly to the lack of power that the people under them were and weren't able to exert.
it speaks to the ways in which we cannot, as a society, rely on the good intentions of those who have, right? Like, we cannot just say, oh, well, people will be good and offer severance. Rich people, the people who run these companies, will run their companies such that they take care of the people who work for them. We need to move into a situation in which those who are doing the work have power in the ability to negotiate as a group. In fact, the reason they're negotiating as they should be negotiating as a group is because that is what will grant them the power to ensure that terms are put into place so that ahead of something like this happening, they can get a heads up so that they can ensure that there will be some sort of severance package or some sort of buyout plan, something. And those things don't just come because – yes, there are cases in which because someone believes in being a good person, they will do that thing. But that is not a reliable way to act. It is not a reliable thing to count on, and it is not a way to structure an industry or to structure society. Like, this is – we live in a society. And that society is not just a bunch of people talking in a circle. I mean, to some degree it is, which is to say it is just people, which means we can change things. We can remake the world in an image that we actually believe in and that supports our morals and our ideals. But to do that means taking steps to ensuring that the right voices are heard, that there are repercussions for not being the sort of person who takes care of your workers, and everything else that goes into that, you know?
Yeah, I think the thing that becomes so disturbing about this particular situation, and not to say that, you know, other, studio closures aren't disturbing, but like kind of what y'all were saying earlier about the types of stories that Telltale was telling, that they were so deep, like they were so deeply rooted in like humanity and like, you know, grappling with, you know, questions of moral value and like just so deeply personal, the stories that were told, that the idea that that does not translate to like any sort of, that the company itself would not have those same, would not be informed by the same, you know, stories that they're telling is so deeply disturbing to me, just as a disconnect between, you know, publishers or developers or, you know, the business putting out between creators and the actual product, like those three.
These are people who make stories about morality and about living a good life and like working in societies and communities and all that. And then their games come out and then this is how they're treated internally. Right. Mm-hmm. There's a disconnect for sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I'm thinking about like how Telltale makes the only treatment of Batman, which the Waynes are depicted as, maybe these people fucking sucked. but I don't think it's unusual. Like the people like making the games, the people actually creating art are often not the ones authorizing checks to go out Friday. And of like I'm like when I hear about that, I flash back to BioShock Infinite, which was like a legendarily high pressure project. Right. And there's a lot of like text in the game about boy, like tough labor conditions and exploitation by management sure are terrible. But then the end of the story for Irrational was, albeit very emotional. Like what Telltale did is still worse than how things ended up at Irrational. But Irrational still ended up in a room where everyone is getting fired.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is a very old story. Hearing all this, it's tough for me not to think about, like, so, some context. I've never gotten severance from any position I've lost. And I don't think I'm unusual in that. I think that is the experience for 90% of people working jobs today, is you're an at-will employee, and at any moment, you know that, like, your paycheck could just go the fuck away. No warning, no severance, no thank you. Probably, if you had benefits, they're cut off immediately. Maybe they'll get the Cobra continuation, but probably not for long.
And good luck paying that, because Cobra is someone who's been
in that
position
before. You think health insurance is expensive.
Yeah. And so, when I think about this, and I'm not couching this in a, like, you people don't know how good you have it, even to have that expectation. But I think there's a tendency for people to use that as a cudgel against people who just suffered a misfortune like this, well, hey, welcome to the rest of the world. Right. You know, like now you're down here with everyone else. And the fact is, like, this isn't acceptable for anyone, but we talk about it more in these industries that are identified as like high skill. We respect the jobs.
Yeah. Right.
We view it as a skill and a craft, and we expect, like, well, surely these people deserve better. Everyone deserves better. Stuff like this stuns us because this is like the forest creeping forward of mistreatment and exploitation of workers, right? Like, oh,
right.
Now this is happening to, you know, people like this. Though this has been the status quo in games for a long time.
Well, like, to your point, Rob, the thing that builds out of it is, like, when you are the person who's working, when I've been the person working retail, right, and, like, scraping by and having been laid off or having had to move because, you know, for a life situation or whatever, and, you know, I'm making minimum wage or making a little bit above minimum. Hey, listen, they made me a key holder. Man, I'm making an extra buck an hour. Hell yeah, right? You look at the jobs like the games industry and you go, ah, one day that'll be me. And when you see from those positions the games industry job, the jobs that you do set up in your mind as being a high skill, career and not just a job, when you see that same instability hit there, there's a sort of shaking of the dream, which is productive in that crisis can be productive. Again, one of the things that's been great about this past weekend has been that those who were laid off have been able to be honest about what their experiences have been, and it's led to a lot of incredible conversation around crunch culture and instability and, you know, career, you know, de-skilling and all the stuff that is important to have a conversation about. But at the same time, it's still frustrating, right? Like, it is still one of those things where it's like, I do want there to be a games industry where people have severance and where people are not working 50 to 70 hours a week. And for me, the two other really frustrating responses that I hear is, one, maybe the most frustrating is the, like, well, why aren't they going to finish the game? Why don't they just finish it?
God.
Why don't they finish it? Why don't
they
put it in the
work? Did you see that one that was like, why don't, if they truly loved it, would they would just work for free?
Yeah, that is like such a common thing.
It was like, oh, well, modders do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, motherfucker, modders should also be able to get paid.
Yeah.
Like,
remember the last time that someone tried to do that?
It's the worst. It is. We had that episode about entitlement a couple of weeks ago. The Danielle led it on the Friday pod, and here we are again. But the second thing that I hear a lot is, well, you can't change it because, like, what would happen? Companies would close. If you got rid of crunch everywhere, companies would start to close. If every company had to pay a fair wage, you know, they couldn't put out as many games, or the price of games would have to go up. And those are all conversations we should be having finally. Please.
I think there's something right there I want to talk about. I've been thinking about this ever since you saw, like, Nestle protesting Australia's anti-slavery law.
Christ, yeah.
And Nestle being like, you know,
Can you explain what that is for people who did not hear this? Because it is wild.
So I might be misrepresenting the statute on the books in Australia or what's being proposed. But
yes,
as I understand it, like, there is a law in Australia that basically tries to verify the slavery-free integrity of your production pipeline. So that any product sold on the shelves in Australia, you know when you buy it, nobody was, like, enslaved to produce it. Nobody was exploited in that way to produce that good. And if a company is found to have violated that or to not have verified some of its suppliers, and it turns out some of them are committing human rights abuses to, like, supply basic materials, then there's penalties.
Yeah.
Nestle was going out there in the grand tradition of Nestle and human rights laws. Nestle was basically, like, concern trolling this and saying, like, you know, these penalties are a little too high. And if we really, like, tighten the screws on this, cost is going to be passed on to customers. And, like, that's obviously a bankrupt position. It's disgusting. But I think what really intrigued me there is, I think there's this tendency in like capitalist market economies to try to paint this picture of everyone as being somehow complicit in exploitation and abuse. Well, you know, you say you want environmental sensitivity, but you still like your fucking phones, don't you? You know, you say you're concerned about slavery, but, like, you still want the semi-sweet Toll House morsels to cost like $2.69, right? And the answer is like, but that's kind of a false proposition, because if you asked most people, what they would choose to do is be like, look, I'll pay $350, $5, whatever, to not have the slavery toll house morsels, right? Like, I will pay the extra charge to make that happen. But what ends up happening is, in a market, people buy less, right? You shifted the price, demand, you've changed where it intersects with demand. And that costs the company money.
Yes.
And so it's not like people are choosing, like, you know, boy, I just, some gamers probably are. Like, these people who are like, you should finish the game for free. Fuck you. There are people who are like that, but I think most people would take the position that, like, no, people should get paid. Like, people should be treated fairly. You're never given the option to express that. You're never allowed to, like, really vote with your dollar, because there's a lot of effort, a la Nestle, in making sure you never get that choice, in making sure that they're allowed to construct a reality where this product costs this much and their business practices are totally unfucking affected and they retain their marginal profit.
And I've seen a lot of people online saying, like, you know, you can't make the argument that game prices should go up because that's just passing the buck on to consumers, which I get for the reasons you kind of just laid out, Rob, which are like, you know, there are ways in which you can internally run the company so that the money that comes in from a purchase shakes out in a more equitable way to the developers, the people who are actually making games and people in QA and people in you know, office ops and everything else. Mm-hmm. But I do think that it's important to be able to have that conversation, because in a more equitable world, in a world where more game studios are co-ops, right, or in small, you know, independently run game studios where there are like four or five or six people and they all own the company or whatever, we should be willing to think about what it actually costs to pay people to live well and to make games. And the prices that we pay, we should be willing to have that conversation so that number, if it needs to go up, you know, might have to go up. That shouldn't be off the table. I'm kind of at the point now where it's like, if we want to remake the world in such a way that major publishers stop releasing 6 or 7 or 8 AAA titles a year and start releasing 2 or 3, we should explore that world. We should be having the conversation that if major publishers should reduce down in size, because it's not possible to sustain business without exploiting your workers, we should be willing to pursue that conversation. And it's not like that's a thing we can snap our fingers and that's the world we're in, but it's one of those things that's like, whatever the space is between where we are now, where people who were working 50 to 70 hour weeks get laid off with no severance from a studio that had the Stranger Things IP, the Marvel IPs, DC IP, like, who had, you know, and I'm not saying those games were all successful.
But all outside appearances, like, this is a successful company that was doing well and is making money.
Yes. Yes, 100%.
Is announcing new things. They were they got into a self-publishing thing where they were picking up indie games and, like, yes, helping usher them on PS4 and Xbox One, like, and guiding them through that labyrinth. They had a press release go out the day of the closure about a game that they were helping, some survival game,
to publish in some way. Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, like, they had their hands in enough things that, like, they're part of the shock of Telltale was that, oh, it seemed, despite what we were hearing about the working conditions, it still seemed like it was a financially solvent company that was going to be able to keep making these. Like, why would you launch a new season, a final season, if you weren't going to find a way to finish it? And so the whiplash on that is so stark, because usually they are, like, Capcom Vancouver, not that surprising after Dead Rising 4, like, a game that was not received very well, clearly didn't sell very well. The fact that the studio has closed is not the most shocking thing in the world, because they followed an arc that is more in line with what we have come to understand when a studio winds down and troubled projects get canceled. And in addition with Telltale, this was a company that had already signaled, oh, we're rebooting. Oh, we've realized that we've been doing things poorly in a number of fashions, both of the forward-facing stuff, like the engine technology they were going to be using, which seemed like that was going to change in 2019.
Right.
And I think that's part of what makes it so – this one stings so much more, is the lies, the deceit. Like, I will not defend someone saying that people should come in and finish The Walking Dead for free. But as someone that truly loved that first episode, has been invested in that series and Clementine as a character, man, it bums me the fuck out to know that those really talented people are not going to be able to finish telling that story. And I mean, they've already said that the only thing they're finishing is the new Minecraft thing they're doing. Like, don't get it in your head that there's just like episodes there that just need a little bit of polishing to be finished. Like, I can't speak specific because I've not been authorized to do so, but I can tell you, like, having heard enough about the state of where that season was, like,
right,
there was tremendous work that needed to be done on the back half in order to have any, like, you would have to, there's no spit polishing. Those episodes were not built.
Think about the way the model works, right? The entire point of the episodic model is that you're able to start getting revenue in on early work so that you can fund the production of asset creation for the later episodes, right? It's like, it's not like they're just sitting on it. It's not like it's a one-stage play where, like, all the sets are already designed. Like, you start releasing the game, it builds momentum, and while the first few episodes are coming out, you're still building out the, like, the sets that you need, the all the different assets, the characters.
This is how TV works. Like, they built this model based, like, when you watch a television show that is, you know, well, these days we have the, oh, we drop a whole season at once. But traditionally, the way television has worked, especially for, like, 26, like, 20-plus episode arcs in which, like, they're taking winter breaks, is, like, when that pilot or that season premiere airs, like, you're mid-season shooting. Like, that is a common model for how this stuff is built. Of course, you know, contrast to that is that in television, you know, they are unionized and have, yeah. You know, there is, like, despite the fact that there is high-stress situations that are occurring while the thing is still in production and yet still airing, you know, there are checks and balances put in place in television production that were not, so they adopted a model without actually adopting the model. So it's right. Like, the idea of starting a season and not finishing it all in one fell swoop, not necessarily, that could work, you know, conceivably, but they didn't adopt the checks and balances for the workers along the way, and that clearly led them astray in all sorts of ways. And, you know, it's man.
I think so. Something for me in that whole, like, they're signing deals until the buzzer, right? there are people who worked at the studio on Twitter who are saying there were offers going out basically until the last minute, which really reminded me.
Had their first day starting like the Monday following the announcement.
We had this happen at 38 Studios, right? When they shut down. There had still been good faith offers going out from HR, who also were in the dark about this, who thought, like, oh, we're still in a staffing up mode. But people in the company, and this is what, like, this is, again, why you need structures and organizations and institutions, because, like, there are ways in which people of goodwill can operate without those things and make sure shit like this doesn't happen. Again, the, you know, offering severance, even though you're not, like, legally gun to your head obligated to.
Right.
I've been through, like, companies that had major layoffs. Shit, Vice has had major layoffs.
Yeah, I was here for them, yeah.
But, like, I was at another company where there were significant layoffs, and, like, leadership kind of put the word out in advance. Like, look, mm-hmm. I don't want you to be surprised by this. Like, it was in the wind. People knew, like, look, maybe don't, like, interview people for this job right now, because that position might be getting, you know, closed off in the next quarter. Like, there are ways to put that out there. People know. If you don't put that out there, then you deliberately obscured that reality, right? You did not give people a heads up, like, this is not the time to be, like, sending out offer sheets. This is not the time. Like, you buried all of that. So, like, that's the other thing that makes this particularly egregious, is you don't just wake up one morning and discover you're in this situation. You know what I mean? Like, there's people who, like, are, like, know the books and know what the state of play is and make decisions based on that. What it sounds like, my question is, did anyone at the company have the ability to know what the score was? Or is this a decision being made by, like, stakeholders who just one morning had enough?
Okay, I think that this is good. I think you're 100%, like, I think what's firing for you right now, and I love it, is the Rob Zachney, who I know has been doing lots of reporting about the state of independent game studios, and you're like, what is the story here? What fucking happened? But there is a deeper thing here, which is, what if we lived in the other world? The world where The Walking Dead season 4 comes out, it gets published, and those people who work there keep working 50 to 70 hour weeks and sometimes crunching, where those people continue to live in a world that's precarious to a degree, it's precarious, but in which that precarity is obscured. Like, even the world in which Telltale stays open is not a great world, except that these people keep getting paid and keep for now at least get to maintain their benefits. Lives and careers and benefits 100%. Like, that is 100% better, but also continue to be exploited, which is why for me the bigger conversation has to be, if this is, again, I see a lot of, like, the comment that happens a lot is, you know, I think this is true also to a point, is when crunch happens to this degree, that is the failure of management, because management is setting bad timelines. Management is over, you know, and is anticipating a larger return than is feasible. You know, is thinking about timelines irresponsibly and unrealistically, and that they should adjust accordingly. I think it's 100% true. I also think that this is working exactly the way it's intended to. That the games industry functions on the backs of people who move in and out of the industry at quick pace. There's super high turnover. There's a lot of high skilled employees who come in, stay at a place for a year or two or a project or two, and then move on to somewhere else or leave the industry altogether. And you know, there are shareholders and you know, C-suite executives who get paid off of all of that, right? Like, this is the industry working as intended. I look at something like Red Dead Redemption 2, the previews all just hit. I'm going to go see that game on Friday. I'm super curious about that game. That game, when I read the previews, when I read about how every character has a name and you can talk to every individual character, and how detailed the guns are and all the objects. You can walk around a store in first person and pick up apples and look at them. And all that shit sounds like a response to everything I've ever wanted in an open world game. Like, go read that piece I wrote on Shadow of Mordor and Watch Dogs from like 4 years ago now on Paste. That game, the previews of that game make it feel like a response to that. And yet I cannot shake from my mind the idea of, like, wow, that must have taken so much work. And the questions that come up from thinking about the history of kind of labor allegations made at Rockstar. I cannot separate the game as it's being previewed from what we've heard in the past about Rockstar. And from what the sheer volume of detail that game allegedly, supposedly has. You know, there was a tweet from Jack DeKeat, who's freelanced for us in the past. He said, if you're previewing Red Dead Redemption 2 and writing about the details, please ask yourselves what the working conditions are that produce details like that. Mm. And this is not an accusation about Rockstar. I don't know. We have not reported that story out. But it's one of those things where we as players have such high expectations, and rarely in our day-to-day as players and consumers do we stop at all to say, what produces this thing? What degree of work comes to this? And it's the same thing that happened in the movie industry a few years ago when visual effects artists stepped forward and said, hey, we aren't given credit. We aren't given royalties. We're the ones who are making, you know, the huge Marvel movies with all these effects be as splashy and spectacular as they are. You don't know who we are, and we're not getting our fair share of pay here. That is still happening in that industry, as far as I know. Like, that was not resolved overnight. But it's a similar question here where I think I'm hopeful that conversations like this one, like the work that Game Workers Unite has been doing over the last year, will push this industry into a place where, for me, it's like, if I don't get my, I've said this before, if it's a choice between people being paid fairly and having equitable, control over the work that they're doing and being able to see their family and friends and being able to, like, work reasonable hours, or me having my dream game, I'm going to choose that first one every time. I'm going to choose that every time.
Yeah. I think the thing here is that a paradigm very rarely shifts, like, just naturally and stays while staying in place. And usually a paradigm must break before a new one can be started, or must, like, be brought down before a new one can be started, which means, and I do not say this lightly, that, like, sacrifices are made, not, like, intentional, not, like, on the people who, like, want to be, or it is deeply unfortunate that the sacrifices are being made by the workers, the creators, and right. You know, and it is not, you know, the business people, but in creating, you know, in because there are spaces being opened with closure, like, with closure creates, like, open space in terms of, like, what can be made anew, that hopefully this is opening up for the start of a new sort of standard or a new paradigm or a new,
A question for you, though. Like, when you're saying sacrifices have to be made, right now people are being sacrificed. That's the, like, are you saying, like, this is a sacrifice? Because I would argue this is, these are people being sacrificed. But for me, I think for what you're describing, what has to happen is people have to be making conscious choices to sacrifice, which I agree with. Like, changes to, like, massive structural changes to the game industry, people are going to lose their jobs before that happens. Yeah. People are going to, like, choose to lose their jobs before
they're
going to
walk
happens.
Away.
Yeah. But at least then it's conscious. Because right now what I see is, and again, like, this is all done with good intentions. This is not something you can point to individual actors and say, like, oh, this is your fucking fault.
Yeah.
Unless, you know, you have, like, $1 billion, in which case it's a little bit your fucking fault. More than a little. But, like, what we see are people putting out, like, the jobs lists. Hey, we're hiring. Come over here. Like, hey, Telltale artists, love your work. Like, come work here.
Yeah.
And 3 years, maybe it'll happen again. Probably will sometime within the next five.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I mean is, like, to break that cycle, I feel like
it has to be broken.
Yeah. And you need people.
You can't just wait for it to. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I think the sacrifices are both. It's things that are sacrificed and sacrifices that are made by, you know, active agents, and sacrifices that are not chosen. And I don't mean that lightly. I don't mean, you know, like we can, you know, if we all just, you know, sacrifice, then we can have the new thing. I do take this, like, super, super seriously. But the thing is, if we are, the thing that you're saying earlier, Austin, which is, like, the bigger kind of nightmare, is that the impasse continues, that we continue, that you know, the creators and workers at Telltale continue in the precarity, continue in and across and at other studios, I'm sure, continue in you know, unhealthy, unsustainable working conditions, and the cycle of burnout continues. If we stay in that impasse, then nothing is going to change. And so whether it is crisis that incites and invokes, you know, change, crisis must have. I don't believe that paradigms just stop.
So we,
without,
like, just convince ourselves, we're just going to change everything.
Yeah, that is what our current political situation is in America. If we do not have crisis, if we do not have
game changers.
If we do not have literal, like, life, just ginormous shifts, then it cannot happen step by step. It has to take, like, leaps of change. So, which means, like, radically, like, having to radically adjust. To radically change the way that we understand and operate and act in certain structures.
And I think some of that, like, radical adjustment involves accepting and making peace with the downsides people worry way too fucking much about when it comes to, like, institutional organized workers' power. I remember being in a room years ago with a bunch of people who, whatever their time on the manufacturing line, whatever, it was long ago in the past. It was a room full of, like, people who now in their mid-career, consultants, managers, executives, and the subject of unions came up. And I was a few years younger back then, so people were still doing the whole, like, ah, young man, you know, you just don't know. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting there, like, basically arguing on behalf of, again, like, why unions are necessary, why they're important. And everyone's like, yeah, you know, that stuff's good. Like, workers should be taken care of. But then all of them were like, but, you know, we've all worked in union. We've all, like, had dealings with unions and, like, worked around union shops. And, you know, unions can be really bad, too. They can make, like, life really difficult. You're trying to make, like, anything happen, union can be a huge fucking roadblock. And you just don't know that. And so it's easy to say, like, unions are good, but you don't know the downside. You don't know all the problems they cause. And the answer is, like, well, problems for who, I think, is the most important thing to consider there. But I think there's a bias, particularly among professional classes or careers that let, like, the arc of that career is the professional path. that one day you're going to be the manager and you don't want these roadblocks. You'll have the agency and you don't want to have to comply with all this shit. And compliance can be annoying. Like, in this old job, like, I was dealing with some of the trades out in the entertainment industry. And, like, I remember an hour-long meeting trying to recall if a crew had fucking lunch during a shoot one day.
Right.
And this was, this like, a lot of money depended on this question. As people are trying to, like, work through, like, hey, do you remember... Did they take a lunch during that shoot? Was it 8 hours or was it six? I can't remember. And like, that stuff is a headache. It's a hassle. But people who imagine themselves as being like the entrepreneurs, the people in charge of things, really resent the idea that someone's going to come up and stop them, right? And say, like, hold on, what the fuck are you doing? Make sure these people are getting paid. What conditions are they working in? I'm going to hold you to those two things. And that means that part of what union does is to be a pain in the ass, to like slam on the brakes, to prevent you from doing shit. And occasionally, and this is the thing, this is the fear that people stoke, and this is what the people were trying to get across to me in that, you know, room years ago, is that, well, if unions are, if there's all these unions around, we won't be able to start as many new businesses, right? We won't have as many new projects. But what that objection amounts to is, I won't be able to assume risk on behalf of other people. Like, mm-hmm. that's what it comes down to. And I feel like certainly in the American discourse, particularly among people who like view themselves as members of the professional class, there is a resentment of that reality.
Yeah.
And I think a big part of like the radical shift in thinking is, hey, maybe someday you will be the person in the suit in the big office. Those jobs are getting harder to come by, period. But like, even if you are,
guess what?
It's still the right thing to do, and it's in everyone's benefit. No, fuck that. It's not in everyone's benefit. It's going to come at the cost of the person in the big office, and we have to be okay with that.
Yep.
But you also have to be realistic. Like, chances are, most of us at some point will, during our lives, need and wish to hell we had the protections that those pain in the ass don't give a fuck trade reps and union reps, you know, bring to the table.
Yeah. It's wild to be here. Go ahead, Patrick.
Oh, I was just going to say, and, you know, on top of that is sort of where our responsibility falls in that. I was frustrated that none of the Red Dead Redemption 2 previews seemed to wrestle with, you know, that everyone was really excited that the testicles change depending on the temperature. And the way the bullets load into the chamber.
Horse testicles, to be clear.
Not the human. I don't know.
You missed that quote. Yeah,
could be the human testicles, knows? Too. I don't know. Like, it's not a real possibility. But yeah, specifically, it was the horse testicles. But, you know, at least pondering that question, including that in, you can still like the game while also raising the question at the same time, like, given the history of this company, what is the cost? If you get in the room with an interview when you're talking to that, I don't think they did interviews with these hands-on previews, a specific knock on that. But when those interviews do happen, like, you should be asking that question. Part of the whole reason we did that series at E3, and one of the reasons I said even the low bar of getting a boilerplate statement next year was progress, is because these companies aren't even thinking the question is going to be asked.
Yep.
And so we need to frame these experiences, our reactions to it, and keep that stuff in mind, if only to, when it's not an expose, know the companies are aware that, like, we are keeping that stuff top of mind, like, it is thought in context with the rest of the work. And when you do get a chance to try and hold those people accountable to person, that you're dedicating time to asking that question. You can ask the questions about the details, right? Like, that's interesting, and like, I'm curious how all that stuff works, but if one part of your follow-ups isn't, And what sacrifice was that for the people? What were the conditions they were doing that in? They might not give you a real answer, but they're not even going to think about it. They're not even going to care about it if there aren't people out there putting some measure of pressure on them. And so it comes from all ways. It all comes from all sides. It's, you know, radical rethinking of how companies are structured. But there's also external pressure that is both, like, look, Red Dead Redemption 2 is going to sell, you know, just fine, regardless of what happens.
The game's going to be a massive success,
But, that, you know, it seems irresponsible on the part of the media to not be thinking of things like that, pushing back on things like that when you are in a position to do so. And as a consumer, if you don't buy Red Dead Redemption 2, it doesn't mean that much. But someone with media, someone with access, like, it is then on your responsibility to be pushing that ball up the hill by asking those questions and seeing what kind of answers you get and thinking about these games with that frame of mind. So, yeah.
Totally. Totally. I guess if I want to leave this on one thing, it's that I think it can be easy to hear what we're saying and hear things like radical shift and, you know, becoming active in a crisis and sacrifice and me saying I'd give up my dream game to make sure there's a world in which people are treated equitably and create a sort of bad faith straw man version of what we're saying that says, like, Waypoint only likes indie games. The only games Waypoint likes is games made by one or two people who only work 12 hours a week, which, you know, good on you if you make a dope game by working 12 hours a week. It's tough. And speaking as someone who both here at Waypoint and my personal side projects also absolutely knows what it's like to put in extra amounts of time. You know, I've said before that one of the big projects for Waypoint this year that I'm happy we've managed is that we've drastically cut down overtime from where we were the year we launched and you know, for the months after we launched and the year that followed. Things have gotten much better around that because we've made
consciously
active choices.
Having yes. each of us call each other out when we're going yes. outside of those boundaries within reason, knowing people right. are going to have to put in extra hours. There are
on certain projects,
blah,
blah, blah. Right.
Things are going to happen. But when we find patterns, when we find people.
Austin, log off. Jesus
yeah,
fucking
yes.
Christ.
And
yeah,
I do.
Yeah,
I do yeah. now. And that is the difference. Well,
yeah, and we've tried to create a culture where. Yes. Where, look, I can't control what you actually do, but I can control that I can tell you you're doing the wrong thing.
I closed my work email at the very yeah. least.
I was sure. having this conversation with my partner, actually. We were taking a walk, and I started thinking about... there's someone I know, like... So, Sham Surjani over at Paradox. Mm-hmm. Like clockwork, in Sweden, they make you take a long vacation. Like, it's like Swedish July, right? That's sort of standard practice. People get a lot of time off in July, and like,
what a great phrase!
Yeah, and like every July, at some point, maybe you didn't do it this year, but like I think every other year, I've seen Shams, who's like an executive over at Paradox, at some point, like kind of complain about like, damn, like, you know, it's kind of annoying that like I want to go back to work, and they're not really letting me. You're kind of chased off and told like go take your vacation, and it occurred to me. There's a lot of people, particularly, like, again, sort of this culture of work that, you know, who are you to tell me I can't work, right? Like, who are you to say that, like, you know, I can't come in and pursue my passion project and all that stuff? And one, you're doing it for your coworkers, right? You might be the most motivated motherfucker in the world. You might love what you're doing. Not everyone is going to be in the same shoes. Not everyone's going to be on the same page at the same time. And so, like, you just build in this expectation so that if you do need to recharge, you get it. You know, there's not this weird like pressure by example of somebody being like, I'm here at dawn and I leave well after dark every night because I just love crushing it,
which right. is huge. Like let's be clear, this is a huge part of the video game industry. Like there have been various studios have tried, let's make games without producers, and like
right.
the result of that is often that you get lots of people staying when they don't need to. I've heard, you know, big projects coming out this fall in which, like, crunch was happening really early amongst people who had nothing to do because they were working on the online yes. components of that game. But the expectation was, well, if everyone else is staying, like, you should stay, too. It's like, well, go get your cot and figure it out. Yeah. And, like, that is pervasive in video games. And I'm sure
we've heard
crunch culture, you know, in technology, yes. everywhere. But the idea that, like, you need people... And this is part of a union. This is part of just a culture of like accountability in an office is telling people like to go home. You need to go home. And when everyone goes home, that's I think what this, you know, Swedish July accomplishes. When everyone goes home, then you remove that as a reason for someone to come in and work. It's like you
a
just
point
can't.
Of comparison. Yeah,
right.
It's gone.
Well, and the other thing, like, and again, like. I like Shams. I also like giving Shams shit. So there's a bit of that here as well. But like the fact that you're like kind of burning to get back to work, that you're like, damn, like they won't like I'm stuck on vacation here and I want to work. That's part of why we do this. Like,
yeah.
I fucking love Waypoint. I love working here. I love hanging with you guys. I love shooting the shit with y'all. If somebody came and was like, hey, Rob, you want to take a month off and just like not check in.
Hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
I would be gone in a shot.
Yep.
Like
yep.
if somebody was like, and all
how
you
is
have
there
to
a
do,
beer in my hand already?
All you have to do
he had
is
that
kneecap.
Actually.
All you have to do is kneecap Austin. I still might do it.
Okay,
I still
listen,
might.
Yeah. Like, it would be nice to see your face at least, yeah. Rob. If you came all the way down here just to kneecap me and take a month for, you know what? I'll go to that pizza
no,
place.
No, look,
it.
I'm a man of honor. Like, I'll do
I
it to your face.
It. All right, I appreciate it.
Look into your heart, Rob. Look into your heart. But, no, but, like, the thing is, that's the thing. Like, no matter how passionate you are, that is also a resource worth, like, conserving and protecting. I think that's the, that's yeah. another, in that better world, what that looks like. Is you don't even come close to burnout. You don't ever, like, maybe you don't hit that right. point where you're like, man, I just want some fucking time off. I'm living for the weekend. Maybe you stay in that place where you remember, like, I would love to get back to my work and love to get back to, like, collaborating with my colleagues. And if you can create that economy, that kind of, like, structure,
right.
then I think you got a work life that's worth living and not one that just steals from your actual life.
And so, like, that gets back to where I was trying to go before when I was talking about the sort of straw man version of what we're saying is, like, it can sound like what we're saying is you cannot make games like Red Dead Redemption. What I'm actually saying is let's remake the world such that we can make games so amazing that we cannot even conceptualize them yet. The world as it stands has hard limits on what can be done because it is organized in such a way that the people who make things, and I don't just mean video games, I mean everything, are so alienated from the things they are making. They are not getting cuts back from the profit that the things that they make derive. They are not part often of the planning around what they're making, what it is. You know, again, speaks back to Rob working on the line in a factory, certainly. They are not often tied to the messaging around how a thing is sold, as we saw with the Deus Ex Mankind Divided a few years ago. And as we see again and again, as really interesting projects in video games and media in general are often sold to the widest possible audience in with the most insulting marketing speak. But there is another world. There could be a world in which those things, those relationships between the things that we make and us as the people who make them are intimate. And are deeply, and there will still be moments in which people get exploited. There will still be moments at which we need to take a step forward and remake the world again. Like I am a firm believer in utopia as process, not as stasis. I don't think that there is a better world in which we snap our fingers and we bring out the guillotines and everything's better after that. Like I firmly believe in that utopia is a mindset and a process. It's an ongoing decision to continue remaking the world in an image that is more equitable for everyone. And in that world, I can't even fucking let me tell you, it's the horse balls, they're amazing in that world. That world blows Red Dead Redemption 2 out of the fucking water, my guy. It's just its temperature, its geography, it's everything. They just adjust to everything. And not just those. Like
altitude.
Everything is just altitude. Exactly. Denver horse balls, different situation.
See, in my utopia, the person being told, like, hey, you need to animate these temperature-sensitive horse balls.
Yeah.
We don't get those horse balls in that world because that person turns to the supervisor and is like, you out of your fucking mind? Fuck you.
No, but I think we get the horse balls because we get someone who's like, man, I'm going to knock these fucking horse balls out of the park. You know? And maybe we don't. We genuinely get
I'm excited to get back
like
to work after my month-long break and work on those horse balls.
Cannot fucking wait.
Can't wait to
know.
Drop
great.
Good. Oh my God.
Uh-huh.
We dropping, boys. I gotta go. This is not.
Where are we dropping?
Yikes. So yeah, I think that is my big takeaways. I genuinely think the sorts of it, and I think we see bits of those games in independent game development and in alternative game development. There was a game that I linked in here, I guess, like a week ago, something like that, called like God, what is it called? I need to find it. It's an itch. It's on itch. It's not an itch.io, an itch.io game, but it is. It was on itch.io, and now I cannot find. Oh, here it is. It's called September 1999. It's like a 5-minute long game that is like a. It's very PT like in its presentation, in that it's like photorealistic with kind of a found footage vibe. It was made by like not one person. 98D Make made it, and it's this like truly terrifying 5-minute game, and it felt like a rupture into a world where games were different. Where like, oh yeah, I spent $3 on this thing, and it's just this really haunting, creepy. Patrick, you should go play this game. You should search.
Yeah, it's been on my list.
It'll take you five. You can play it right after this in 5 minutes. It's worth doing because it's fucking creepy. And like things like that make me so excited about the world of games because they feel like something is changing at the kind of base level, at the very foundational level of the organization of the world, in which more people can make games now than ever. And that doesn't necessarily mean that everything's great, but you know, it is a step in the right direction at least.
It has to start somewhere. And like the fact that we're having these conversations, the fact that Game Workers Unite exists, the fact that one of the prominent conversations post release or post closure of Telltale is like, wait, what the fuck went wrong? Why did this go wrong? How can it be better? I mean, this stuff takes time. It takes decades. It takes a generation, you know. But, like, the existence of the conversation is more than what we had 5 years ago.
Totally.
And so, you know, you start the foundation somewhere and you build on top of that.
Totally. We should have taken a break like 30 minutes ago. We did not do that. Unfortunately, let's take a super quick break right now and then come back and very quickly hit some stuff before we have to wrap up, because I know Kato, there are some people coming into that room in just about 15 minutes. So we're talking about games super quick. No waypoints this week because we're continuing the show waypoints. We're just have to do like waypoint size game talk. So okay. BRB.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
All right, we are back. Video games. Let's talk about them. I'll go first. Forza Horizon 4. That game is really pretty. It has cars. The seasons are great. The cars feel really good to handle. It's wild that every time I play a game like The Crew 2 or whatever that Need for Speed was last year, I go, maybe I don't like driving games anymore. And then I play a Forza Horizon, and I'm like, man, driving games are actually extremely good. I don't have a lot to say about it. I only put like 4 or 5 hours in, so maybe more than that. I'm up to winter. You kind of starts in summer, and then you work your way through summer, autumn, winter. And
so it's the Last of Us of...
Yeah, The Last of Us games. Of open-world driving games. Yes, exactly. There are stunt races, and I think one of my favorite things is... So there's a light story mode in which you are literally a driver at this kind of car festival. And there's a running theme A Horizon Festival is like a music and car festival that is the... You know, it's a Horizon
Festival. I take this canon serious.
Ella.
Yes. It's... Right. Exactly. Thank you.
Get it?
Yeah, I get it. There's a great bit where you picked up to be a stunt driver. Rob's walked away from the microphone, which is great. And in the first set of missions, he's opening a window now. He's standing near a giant plant. I think he's just checking in with the world outside. Which is
maybe he's trying to imagine a better world, a different world.
A different world. Really, the point I want to make is my favorite thing so far has been the first stunt race is this big thing where there's like a plane chasing you and it's like a big action movie. And the second one is like, get in this vintage race car and drive by the ocean. And all of like the director for the movie is like, listen, man, I don't fucking know. I know it doesn't seem like a lot of stunts. The stunt today is just drive this cool looking car near the ocean and look cool. Yeah, I'm on it. Don't worry about it. I'm going to keep putting time into that. Patrick, what have you been playing?
That was a long... Rob is finally...
Rob's
You're
returned.
Back, Rob?
Yeah, back.
Welcome back. Patrick.
Very quickly, I finished The Messenger over the weekend, a game that, as I wrote on Twitter, I thought had a like all-time awful start. I think the first 3 hours
I'm
of the
game
are rough. I think I mentioned on a previous podcast that I don't have a whole lot of affinity for Ninja Gaiden, not because I don't like it. I just was not part of my growing up. And so, like,
this, you hate
like,
the classics. I got it.
Yeah, exactly. Got me. Damn. It just felt like a very rote action platformer that like wasn't challenging me in a lot of ways that I found to be particularly compelling. And then in the sort of like there's a turn that happens for like the latter two thirds of the game in which it sort of opens up. It's more of a Metroid style game, and I found that to be like has its own faults, but like was very compelling and I really enjoyed that like 10 hours or so that I spent going through that. And when I tweeted that, the response I got was super fascinating because I say it's split 50-50 where a lot of people felt exactly the same way I did. And then there was a whole nother half that were like, hey, actually, when the game made the twist, I hated it, actually. Yeah. And it became a game I didn't want to play. I wanted the Ninja Gaiden game and them to just keep expanding upon that. And so it's interesting where I'm advocating for people to show patience and get through the twist. And for a lot of people, when they got to the twist, they wanted the game they were playing before. And that game, in a lot of ways, goes away, or at least is downplayed in favor of different elements. And so it's just fascinating to see that, because I just did not expect that reaction at all. I thought everyone was on the same page as me. Yeah, it's something I'm going to try and put a couple of words behind, because just the game's choice to make that twist worked for me, but I guess I didn't quite consider what it'd be like if actually you wanted the game it was pitching you before right. that.
Like you're genuinely saying, what if your taste was just different?
Yeah.
And you had this really dope thing, and then it got swept away.
Yeah, and that's what the game does. And for me, it does it in favor of something I enjoyed more, but for not insignificant number of people, they preferred the original one, and actually there were people who were like, I kind of put the game down after that, which is just it's just interesting. Like, reactions. Yeah. Hey, people have different feelings on things. So, that's special. I liked it. I enjoyed it. I'm glad I played it, and I'm glad I finished it.
Natalie, what have you been playing?
I'm playing Undertale still.
Hell yeah.
For the first time. No spoilers.
No spoilers. I was in Lobby 1 with you and Kato the other day, and we were both like, oh, what are you playing? And you were like, and you turned up the volume, and we both heard it was the fight against, we heard which fight it was. We're like, oh, is that blah? And you were like, yeah? Like, oh, yeah, it's so good. The music in that game was just, like, so memorable.
It is. I'm surprised how much it's, like, starting to, it does a really good job of repeating music in a way that creates an association with that song or with that tone that keeps past things that have happened in the game fresh in your mind.
Yeah.
Which, you know, playing a game, you can, like, a lot of, when you move forward, a lot of things in the past can get lost because there's just so much, especially with narrative and story, you know, like for me, I have a hard time keeping track of everything and keeping everything in my brain. So having those like audio kind of cues to bring things back is really neat, and I'm having a really hard time beating a boss right now, but I'm hoping to get through it.
Story of Undertale.
Soon.
Yeah, I'm hopeful that you get through because it's a super great game. For people listening who have not played that game, because I know that I almost didn't play it when it first came out because the fandom roar about how good it was so off-putting to me because and I'm not saying you can't be loud about the things you love in life, but sometimes it can feel like there's such a pressure put on you because what if I just don't like it? And then I feel like an asshole and I can't talk to people about it. I'm in almost like in a safer position to have never played it.
Yeah.
There's like a reason I don't play there's a reason I don't play a lot of video games. There's like there are games that I do not play because like I know my tastes. I've played Uncharted 1 and 2. I don't need to play Uncharted 3 and 4 because I'm going to be the person who's like, yeah, it didn't do it for me. I'm sorry. And there's so many other good things to play in it. But, now that we're a couple years removed, give Undertale a shot, maybe.
Yeah.
It's good.
I also super quick played the Dark Souls Remastered online beta Switch.
Nice.
I died a million times, and then
Hell
I quit.
Yeah.
So.
Welcome to Dark Souls.
Can't wait to do this all over again and cry.
Oh, Lord. That game.
I got
exciting.
Invaded in, like, the first 30 seconds that I loaded in, like, my first time, and I was like, hello? And they just killed me, and I was so angry. I was like, I'm just trying to swipe. I don't
and
know.
And you wanted your internet
I have
up.
To... Now, I need to link you to a story I wrote about when I played through Demon's Souls. I streamed my entire experience to that, and I was stalked by one invader in particular.
Oh, my God.
Potato something.
That's
I can't.
So
his name. His name
Fuck.
Escapes me. But there was someone who... And I actually think he had a history of stalking Giant Bomb... I think he's talking either Brad or Vin, someone. I think he was not his first rodeo, but he constantly hounded me, and I refused to turn off the internet. Like, I was like, no, mm-hmm. this is part of my experience, this is part of my life. But he was my eternal torturer, and it's a very memorable story in retrospect. Less fun at the time. The invading aspect it's so down. I forgot that you've only played Bloodborne, and the invading part is basically non-existent in that game because it's participatory. You have to invite,
which
you,
I like,
inviting cooperation, then you can be invaded, but you can play that game solo very easily. Whereas in Dark Souls, like, it's just a lot. And now, because the community is going to be so fresh, there's just going to be invaders all over the place, which in a way sounds exciting for me, less exciting for you potentially.
Yeah.
There are ways to just never be a human, you know, just always be undead and you'll be fine. We'll talk about it.
What?
I'll give you some. Don't worry about it. You know what? Yeah. Don't worry about it.
Huh?
Rob?
Yeah.
What have you been playing?
So this weekend I played a little bit of War of the Ring. I taught it to a good friend, Good Nick from the Subterfuge game.
Oh, Good Nick.
Yeah.
Yeah. Friend of the site.
Yeah, friend of the site, salt of the earth, good fellow all around.
Why does it sound like you're about to twist a knife in his back?
Well, I don't know. That's my question. Did I stab him in the back, or did I teach him a game and a valuable lesson about how to play it well? So War of the Ring is, for my money, one of the best board games ever made. I mean, it's a brilliant war game, and every playthrough is like your own telling of the Lord of the Rings books. And one of the things in this game is that while the map you're playing on, the sort of the military front, is very, like, the game's all in front of you. It follows, you know, standard rules of strategy. It's very readable. You hold cards in your hand that can tilt the odds pretty radically in your favor in different places, different contexts. One of the things that happens over the course of the game is the shadow player brings out Saruman. And Saruman gives you an extra action dice each turn, and that basically lets you make another move every turn. It's very powerful to bring Saruman out. Saruman, as you will remember, is based at Isengard. And you might recall, like, the way Saruman goes down is that he, you know, clear cuts a forest that turns out to be full of living, sentient trees, and they come, like, the Ents awaken, and they fuck up his shit.
Yeah.
There's two cards in this deck that the good players have that basically, like, let you roll for the Ents. And it's a devastating attack. Like, they are very powerful, and they can basically, like, wipe out everything at Isengard in the space of a heartbeat. I had two of these cards that I've been holding for the entire game. Nick has never played this game before. He doesn't know. Like, I told him, like, hey, like, you know, there's some, careful about Saruman, like, there's some landmines in the deck. There's some landmines in the deck for him. So you should watch out for that. But then I also made sure he knew how to bring out Saruman. I was like, hey, you should make sure, just, you know, just if you consider, remember, you can bring out Saruman now. So I sat on these two cards that I got early in the game for like several turns. And he went all in on Helm's Deep. And it was glorious. Like, he played this card that, like, made battle way more lethal. And his idea was he's going to end the siege by storming Helm's Deep.
Uh-huh.
Instead, his entire army died, and I had one soldier left. But if you lose your entire army, all your leaders, a.k.a. your Nazgul, and any characters on the spot, a.k.a. the Witch King, die. And they're gone. And forever. Isengard was empty. And so my one surviving soldier just starts walking from Helm's Deep to Isengard, and he's like, oh shit, I should probably. So he garrisons Isengard, he puts two troops up, and he's like, great, I can, like, ride out a siege. Ents don't give a shit about your siege rolls.
Ents don't give a shit.
Ents are coming straight the fuck in.
They're big tree people.
So I play the first card, he survives the attack, he's like, yes, made it. And I was like, okay, but also that card allows you to chain another card to it. The Ents are still attacking. Horns is the name of the card. And they killed all the troops. They stormed Isengard and killed Saruman. And then a turn later, I blitzkrieged Moria and basically won the war as the Free People on the military front, which is very rare.
Wow. You don't even need Frodo.
No, don't even need. Just, you know, Frodo, you've done enough.
The fuck out of here. You keep the ring. That's all you can.
Put your feet up. Relax. We got this.
Sam, go get a little place by the marshes, you know? Yeah. Like, open a bakery or something, I don't know.
So, my view is, we had a good first game, I taught him the game, and I taught him some of the car-driven dynamics of this beautiful strategy game that is War of the Ring.
God.
There's another view that maybe I exploited his lack of knowledge about the game.
You are Austin, and I am Nick, and this is Bloodborne.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Anyway, that was my weekend. I'm a good coach,
is what you're saying.
I slept like a baby.
Perfect. Good. Last little recommendation here, last note before we wrap up. Heat Signature, which is one of my favorite games last year. It's been a year since that game came out. And later this week, there is a big patch that's hitting. You can already play it if you go into Steam and go into your, like, the properties for the game and pick the next version in your, like, betas or whatever. But there's a ton of new stuff in this new update that is all super fucking cool. If you don't remember what that game is, you can go to our YouTube channel. I think there's an archive of a stream that I did of it there. It's like a space heist game. You're a space heister. You get into a little tiny pod and then crash into big spaceships and then take care of their guards and steal cool things that have names like the Castle Rose apparatus or whatever. It's super rad, and the update is filled with, like, new enemy types, like all new AI subroutines, a lot of tweaks to the way the defensive AI works so that characters are a little, so the missions are, like, way more dynamic, all sorts of, like, new types of missions and items and a bunch of other stuff that are all character traits, which is, like, my favorite one, because it usually just be like, oh yeah, you're a person who has a mission and then you go do these other missions until you can afford to go do your big, you know, proc gen mission. But now maybe you get the trait that says, like, you're dying, which means you have 10 minutes to live and get all of the shit done that you need to get done with that character. Or you have frail, which means that you can't do any lethal damage instantly kills you and you don't get a chance to, like, revive yourself the way you normally do because you have a bunch of space technology. It's super cool. So go check that out for sure. I think that's going to do it for us today. Unfortunately, we did not have time to get into the question bucket because we have someone coming in to take a look at the studio and hopefully rewire it so that we can podcast better. You can find me on Twitter at Austin_Walker. Where can people find you, Natalie?
At Natalie Watson.
How about you, Patrick?
At Patrick Klepik.
Rob.
At Rob Zachney.
As always, you can find Waypoint at twitter.com/waypoint, facebook.com/waypointvice, and over at waypoint.vice.com. If you have comments, you can send those over to gaming@vice.com. You can also put questions there, and ideally you put question in the subject. That way we know that it's a question, and it shows up on our little bucket where it says question, our question bucket, if you will. You can also go talk to us over at discourse.zone or forum.waypoint.vice.com. And as always, shout-outs to Bowen for letting us use the track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. Find out more about that at waypoint.zone/BOEN. Danielle isn't here today, so I need somebody else to help take me out. Who's got something? Rob Zachney.
Ethically contracted horse testing.
Peace.
I had something.
Yeah, you sure did.